Our next case for argument this morning is Buzynski against FDIC.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Watson. I'm here today representing the FDIC as the receiver for the failed Superior Bank. The FDIC asks this court to reverse the district court's order of remand and direct that this case proceed in the federal district court. And I hope to address 3 points in my limited time. The first is that the plain language states that the FDIC has 90 days to remove from the day it is substituted as a party. And the district court in this case replaced that language substituted as a party with the language was appointed as receiver. The second is that the legislative history demonstrates a clear congressional intent that FDIC have 90 days from filing a copy of the order of appointment of receiver with the state court. And finally, I'd like to address that there's no policy basis for creating a different removal period for the RTC as receiver and the FDIC as receiver, and also that the policy concerns in the cases referred to by the district court are addressed in the FDIC's interpretation. The first, the plain language of the statute, as I said, in Section 1819, the statute in 1991 was amended to expressly authorize the FDIC to remove cases within 90 days from the day FDIC is, quote, substituted as a party. The district court, claiming that there were competing interpretations of that language substituted as a party, replaced the language with a ruling that it was a 90-day period from the FDIC's appointment as receiver. As I said, the district court was wrong that there were competing interpretations of that language substituted, and the Bukowskis have also argued, as appellees, that Congress adopted a judicial interpretation of substituted in pre-amendment cases that were relied on by the district court. And that's just false. Prior to 1991, there was a void in the FDIC statute. While it had the authority to remove, it was silent as to the period for removal and as to the triggering event, what would begin that period. So the courts prior to 1991 referred to the general removal statutes. And the courts came to different conclusions. Those competing conclusions were policies in the absence of any statutory language. And the courts, at least the courts of appeals, essentially split on that. The First Circuit and the 11th Circuit, as relied on by the district court in this case, determined as a matter of policy that the time should run from the FDIC's appointment as a receiver. The Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit rejected that approach and rather found that the FDIC's substitution as a party or intervention in the case was the appropriate triggering event. In 1991, Congress ended that debate by expressly authorizing 90 days from the time that the FDIC is substituted as a party. And we would submit that the district court has effectively rewritten the statute by finding that that language is intended to mean was appointed as receiver.
You indicated in your brief that the 11th Circuit acknowledged that change, right? It said whether the date of the action or suit proceeding filed against the FDIC or the date of the FDIC is substituted as a party as opposed to the date the FDIC is appointed as a receiver.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the I-85-1 case, which was decided following the 1991 amendments, the 11th Circuit was forced to examine what the effect of the amendments was, and the court concluded that the amendment expanded the FDIC's authority and expressly stated that it was 90 days from the substitution as a party and that the amendment abrogated the Lazuka's decision that it was 90 days from the appointment of the receiver. And I would again stress that the Lazuka decision, the earlier 11th Circuit decision, was not interpreting the language substituted as a party. Rather, it reached a policy decision and analogized it to the general removal statutes, first notice of the removability of a case. The legislative history in this case, even if the district court were right that substitute as a party was an ambiguous phrase susceptible.
Why should we look at the legislative history?
I don't think that it's necessary to look at the legislative history, Your Honor. All right. As I've indicated,
the Supreme Court has said that maybe, just maybe, it could be used to disambiguate terminally ambiguous language. But you've told us there is no ambiguous language.
That's so correct,
Your
Honor.
You've told us that under the Supreme Court's standard, it would be inappropriate for us to look at the legislative history.
I believe that's correct, and that the district court erred in not following the plain language of the statute.
But you obviously don't have the courage of your own convictions.
Rather, Your Honor, I believe that it's necessary to point out that even under a different analysis, if a court were inclined to turn to the legislative history, that analysis wouldn't change the answer.
You can rest easy. No member of this court wants to look at the legislative history.
Well, Your Honor,
Of all labor-saving devices, and not looking at the legislative history is a major labor-saving device.
Well, rather than turning to the legislative history, I'd like to now turn to the policy considerations
That's even lower than the legislative history.
Well, it seems to be, though I'd argue, Your Honor, it seems to be the underlying rationale relied on by the district court, and that's why I think I do need to address it, not merely as support for the application of the plain language, which, as you've indicated, would be appropriate, but the policy concerns that were articulated in the Woburn case that is so dramatically relied on by the district court and by the Bukowskis essentially concludes that the FDIC would have the power to extend its period for removal ad infinitum, that it is an unending period for removal. But as the Fifth Circuit made clear in the Diaz decision, that is not a policy concern that the district court should have had or that this court should have, because it's within the power of the Bukowskis in this case. It was within their power to bring the FDIC into the litigation. It's not solely the FDIC's right to begin to implement the triggering event and begin the 90-day period. A plaintiff against the FDIC has the same opportunity to bring the FDIC into the lawsuit and trigger the 90-day period. So it isn't a policy concern that, and the district
Why
court...
Why did the state litigation continue for years after Superior went insolvent and the FDIC took over?
I can't account for that, Your Honor. The record in this case only establishes, I think, one clear fact, and that's that the FDIC as receiver didn't know of the litigation.
Who was representing Superior Bank and then the FDIC at the time?
Well,
somebody who didn't know his own client?
I would distinguish the FDIC's counsel in this case from counsel that purportedly represented Superior Bank. He never made any affirmative statements that I'm aware of, and the record certainly doesn't reflect it, that he represented a receivership or that the institution was in receivership. Ms. Oliva...
My suspicion is that he didn't know. You know, if I had to,
I believe
to go by suspicion, it would be that lawyer had been deputed to the case by the insurance company.
I would as well, Your Honor.
Really representing the interests of the insurer rather than either Superior Bank or the FDIC.
I agree, and that's my colloquial understanding. That's my understanding of who he represented.
Was the lawyer somebody being furnished by the insurer having taken over the defense?
That's my understanding. Indeed, I believe he represented Ms. Oliva in her individual capacity prior to the third amended complaint that eventually added Superior Bank prior to its being closed. I mean, one thing that is apparent is that at no time...
Because it implies that his bills were then being paid by the insurer. Normally, if the person paying your bills becomes insolvent, a lawyer would notice.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, but would point the court to the final attachment to the motion for remand. The discovery that was conducted doesn't indicate there was any discovery that particularly involves Superior Bank or certainly the FDIC as receiver. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Long.
May it please the Court, Kenneth Wong on behalf of the plaintiffs Wendy and Donald Butchkowski. Your Honors, the FDIC misses the mark when they argue that the pre-amendment cases did not define substituted as in relation to when the FDIC's removal deadline begins.
So
as
the pre-amendment cases you're referring to now?
Yes, Judge. Yes. As the district court pointed out below, there was and remains substantial pre-amendment authority concerning the FDIC's automatic status as a party upon and by virtue of its becoming the receiver. Numerous courts have held that the FDIC becomes a party without informal intervention, without having to go through the technicalities of intervening and having its petition for intervention be granted.
It doesn't look like the current statute makes that assumption. What's the function of saying substituted as a party if the FDIC just becomes a party and never has to be substituted?
Well, as
it looks like this is a statute that makes something turn on a change in the books, right, rather than anything automatic.
Well, Judge, it's our position, and as the Espinoza Court held, the substituted merely adds the definition that had already been there. In Espinoza, the District Court in Massachusetts, a post-amendment case, specifically stated that in the First Circuit at that time, post-amendment, the FDIC is deemed to be, quote, substituted as a party, end quote, at the time of its appointment as receiver. Therefore, the amendment must mean appointment as a receiver as the time to start the removal process.
That's something I don't understand. There are provisions in the civil rules for substitution. If there's a change in office holder, the substitution is automatic. In any other, right, so when Attorney General Ashcroft turns into Attorney General Gonzalez, the substitution is automatic. Nobody has to do anything. Any other form of substitution under the civil rules requires action, requires the filing of a document, and then the court has to grant the substitution. Why would we understand substituted as a party in this statute as anything different from the norm in practice, that unless it's a change in office holder, it requires actual action in the court?
Your Honor, because that's how it had been defined in the past, in the Woburn Court, in the Lazuka case, in Farina, in a case that didn't necessarily have to do with this specific issue. The Farina Court, the Fifth Circuit, specifically affirmed federal subject matter jurisdiction based upon the FDIC's status as the receiver without any kind of formal intervention. The holding being they became the party. They were substituted for the party. For the bank upon appointment as receiver.
Yeah,
this case was back in 1980.
You're not really addressing my question, though. That is, there is a norm in federal practice on what substituted means, how it works, whether it's automatic or not. And then Congress adopts a federal statute using the phrase substituted as a party. Why should one understand that phrase to be different from the norm in federal practice? I'm not asking whether Court A had held X in 1980 and whether the Fifth Circuit had held the opposite. I'm asking about the normal way words are used in federal practice.
And the answer, Your Honor, is because that had been the judicial definition of substitution.
No, it hadn't been. There had been a conflict among the circuits. So I'm asking why we should treat this statute as departing from the norm in federal practice.
Well, the conflict among the circuits had been when did the time limit start?
Yeah, well,
but in terms
I give up. I don't want you to talk about conflicts or cases. I'm asking a question about principles of statutory interpretation.
And my point, Your Honor, is even the Fifth Circuit agreed that for purposes of removal, being allowed to remove a case, the FDIC didn't have to intervene because it became a party. It was substituted as a party at the point it was appointed as a receiver. And that's the judicial definition which the Espinoza Court relied upon and which the canons of statutory interpretation require or tell us that Congress had to have been aware of when it amended the statute.
Well, I think another reason. If you're going to rely on the cases, you mentioned Lazuka and the 11th Circuit reversed that.
Well, Your Honor, as the district court pointed out, that issue was not before the 11th Circuit in the 85.
So this court is incorrect.
Which court?
what says that the date of the action, suit, or proceeding filed against the FDIC or the date the FDIC is substituted as a party as opposed to the date the FDIC is appointed receiver.
That is a that well that's dicta first of all. As the district court in this case pointed out, that was not the issue before the 11th Circuit in that case. It did not involve the issue of the FDIC when it's substituted as a party. The issue was, could they remove when a counterclaim is filed against them? So the time period at issue was the other prong of the removal statute, which was when an action is filed against the FDIC. So that aside, that comment is an aside. It is dicta. It is not the result of an analysis of these issues, and I believe the district court was entirely correct in regarding it as unpersuasive. The same can be said of the Keating case, which the FDIC relies on. That issue was not before the court. The only issue there was, can the FDIC remove after final judgment? The facts aren't laid out as to exactly when they were appointed receiver, but one can certainly infer from those facts that perhaps they removed within 90 days of being appointed as a receiver. Another reason why the definition of substituted in the FDIC's removal statute means what the Espinoza Court has held it means, and the district court in this case has held, is that the RTC statute and the FDIC statute are entirely different. Congress, in the face of a judicial definition of a term, amended one statute and changed the definition explicitly. Then amended another statute, the FDIC statute, and did not change that definition. And in interpreting those acts, one is left with presuming Congress knew that definition and intended for that definition to remain the same for the FDIC. The RTC and the FDIC statutes are entirely different. The interesting thing about that argument is it was not brought up. It was not brought to the district court's attention in response to the motion to remand. It was only brought up in the motion to reconsider. The FDIC's contention below originally was the time limit starts to run only upon actual intervention, only upon actual substitution, being granted leave to intervene in a case. Then upon the motion to reconsider, the argument became, no, the time limit begins to run when a paper is filed with the court telling the court that the FDIC has been appointed receiver. Perhaps the reason for that change is the FDIC realized it never had been formally substituted. It had never had leave granted for it to intervene. The plaintiff's position is that it doesn't need that permission because it is already substituted as a party when it is appointed. And it is that line of cases which defines substitution pre-amendment and which the Espinoza case pointed out continued after the amendment when Congress did not explicitly change the definition in the FDIC statute. The court brought up a very good question. How did this case go on for 3 years after the FDIC was appointed? How were 20 depositions taken? And then on the day of trial, how could the plaintiffs first learn that a receiver was present? Regardless of whether the FDIC had notice or not of this case.
Do you have an answer to that question?
I do not, Your Honor.
Why didn't you substitute the FDIC as the party?
The plaintiff certainly had no knowledge of a proceeding or the fact that the FDIC had been appointed the receiver.
As far as you're concerned, the bank was solvent.
As far as we were concerned, the bank was solvent. The bank continued to play the lawyers representing both the individual and the bank. Continued to prosecute the case, to defend the case, and gave the plaintiffs no indication that there was any change in the status of the bank. As soon as the plaintiffs found out about the appointment, the plaintiffs filed administrative claims and would have done so immediately had they been properly notified years before. But as the district court pointed out, it doesn't matter whether they had notice or not. They're charged with notice. It's only the FDIC can find out what cases the bank is involved in, and decide whether to remove or not, and do it timely and early in order to avoid the delay and the complete waste of judicial resources that the cases have talked about and has happened in this case. Unless there are any further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Watson?
No, Your Honor.
Then thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.